Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's Podcasts. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest mountains, we are ready for Chapter 12. Nice Catch, Mount St. Elias, 2000. Here we go. If someone had asked me if I would go to St. Elias only a year after King Peak, I would have laughed. However, I was not the only person who felt the pull. Chris now understood the magic of the St. Elias Range, and yes, we put together another star-studded team of six. I called this the A-Team. First on our list was strongman Tim Haig. Tim worked all winter as a ski patroller, and his goal for each summer was to go north to whatever peak Chris and I planned. Of course, Tim had also seen St. Elias from King Peak, and he was up for the challenge. Tim loved the snow. Also up for the challenge was Mike Butane. Newcomers to our cadre included Bob Wood, who came with a sharp wit tempered by an easygoing competence, and Jim Ricard, a mellow fellow who quietly climbed the hardest peaks around. We would climb the south ridge of St. Elias. Like King Peak, St. Elias has no easy tourist route to the top. The north ridge that the Duke of Abruzzi climbed way back in 1897 for the first ascent of St. Elias was now dangerous to reach due to avalanche hazards. The bottom of the ridge itself is not a ridge, but a face, and that had also turned into an avalanche trap. My good friend Charlie Campbell of Logan and Four Acre fame had tried this route and was completely buried by an avalanche low on the Abruzzi Ridge. His partners dug him out and he survived, but was so shook up that he quit climbing. The West Ridge is a long, complicated affair. Then you have to traverse the 3-mile west shoulder to reach the top. The East Ridge is even harder. The South Ridge, while difficult to approach and steep, provides a direct route to the summit. We tackled the difficult logistics of reaching the South Ridge with the help of ace pilot Paul Klaus. For starters, he and his dad ferried us to a staging area on the northwest side of St. Elias with his big beaver plane and his turbocharged Super Cub. Next, Paul ferried us one by one in his Super Cub up to a short, precarious landing at 9,700 feet on the west ridge of Hayden Peak. This was a huge head start. When I attempted St. Elias in 1984, we started from a landing on the Tyndall Glacier on the southwest side of the peak at 2,200 feet. We ferried loads for 10 days to reach our Camp 3 on the ridge at 9,700 feet. So, I figured that I had already climbed the lower part of the mountain. My job this time was to finish the upper part. The first section of our climb would take us to Hayden Col at 10,250 feet. To do this, we had to traverse the north face of Hayden Peak. This was one of the crux moves of the climb, since Hayden's north face was famous for avalanches. We had done this traverse in 1984, and had been sweating bricks both going and returning. The trick was to drop down below the steepest sections of the face, and this made it less likely that we would trigger an avalanche ourselves, but if a big one came from above, we would still be in the path. The length of the traverse exposed to avalanches was long, and the snow was soft, making it difficult to just zoom across. Chris and I made a good team, since we had opposite quotes about how we should proceed. My quote was, "We can climb anything if we're comfortable enough." Chris's quote was, "If there's a chance I won't need it, I'll leave it behind." After bantering, we usually ended up with a good compromise between these two extremes. We did not plan on relaying a load to Hayden Col. With our head start, we would make one trip across the danger zone. Chris also wanted to launch with only 6 days of food, and I knew that was not enough. If we were to have another weather miracle Like last year on King Peak, that would work. However, this was St. Elias, smack next to the Gulf of Alaska, aka the Pacific Ocean. I don't believe in planning on a miracle, especially repeating one. After our usual banter, I talked Chris into taking 8 days of food, but even that would prove to not be enough. Welcome to St. Elias. The day after flying in, we launched. Fresh, we stomped along with vigor, dropped down when needed, then did a slow climb to the vicinity of Hayden Col. We did not plan on camping right in the col for two reasons. The actual col is a bit of a knife edge, and it can be raked by ferocious winds. We carved out a secure camp 100 yards southwest of the col and settled in. So far, the weather was fine. Now, the summit was only 7,800 feet above us in a horizontal distance of 2.25 miles. We had to gain about 3,500 feet per mile. Welcome to St. Elias. In a perfect universe, we could be on top in 2 days and back in our comfortable col camp in 3 days. However, the universe is not perfect, and even if perfection happens once in a while, it's almost impossible to be perfect all the time. Indeed, I had been at Hayden Col in 1984 and had not made the summit of St. Elias. What I did succeed in doing in 1984 was summiting Hayden Peak, and even that was a surprising climb. I took a photo from the summit of Hayden Peak in 1984, looking down on Icy Bay that would gain in importance as decades passed. That photo showed ice way out into Icy Bay. While I didn't summit Hayden Peak in 2000, I did take a similar photo of Icy Bay from Hayden Peak's West Ridge. That photo showed that miles of ice had melted in 16 years. Now you can paddle a sea kayak to within 8 miles of the summit of St. Elias, making St. Elias the highest coastal mountain in North America, and arguably the world. Back to the future. Our next mission was to move our camp up the lower angle slopes at 13,200 feet, and this would be our high camp. We trimmed our weight to a minimum. We left some food and one tent at the col camp. Our move to high camp with full packs up 3,000 feet on a steep, icy slope proved to be an exacting affair. It was all a no-fall zone, meaning that if you fall, you die. Welcome to St. Elias. After thousands of careful steps, we arrived on the lower angle slopes and created another secure camp. I had reached this spot in 1984 and now only lacked the summit climb. Would tomorrow arrive with summit weather? The predictable but still sad answer was no. How long we could wait at high camp depended on how much food we had brought up with us. It wasn't enough. After a few days, we knew that we had to do the unthinkable, which was to return to col camp and bring up the food we had left there. Sleep high, carry low was completely backwards, but we had no choice. The gang went down, got the food, but on the return up the no-fall zone, Mike became sick. He had brought a bug with him from home. It had matured and now laid him low. Unfortunately, he was quite high on a tough mountain. There were anxious moments when it was not clear if he could make it back up the no-fall zone. It took a while, but Mike made it back up. Now what? The next day was clear, but windy and rattling cold. We stood outside the tents for a conference about starting for the summit, but we were still inside our snow walls around the camp. Finally, I suggested that the conference should occur outside the walls in the full force of the wind. We reconvened outside the walls, but no conference was needed. Conditions were too tough for a summit climb up 4,800 feet. The only good news was that the weather did seem to be getting better. The next morning was still cold and windy, but better, so all of us except Mike started for the summit. I asked Mike if he was sure that he didn't want to try, but he was emphatic that he was still too sick. As we shouldered our summit packs, Tim said, "I can lead to the top." Then he took off up the initial hill, and the rest of us hustled to catch up. We had to gain a whopping 4,800 feet up steep terrain that we didn't know much about. The weather, while better, was still far from perfect, and the summit still loomed over us like a big question mark. There was nothing to do but set a steady pace. Each measured step up was a keeper. The terrain varied from steep slope to narrow ridge, and while we were roped, there was considerable trust that nobody would fall, since it was not clear that the rope would do any good. When we reached the lower angled terrain at 15,000 feet, we could see the final 3,000-foot steepening sweep to the summit. We were cautiously optimistic, but still wondered about the weather. There was a sea of rising cloud below us, and the upper air seemed funky. Nevertheless, we were now in go-for-it mode. However, we still had to get through the summit mushrooms that overhung our entire slope, indeed, our entire hope. We crunched up onto the extortionate steepness only 1,000 feet below the summit. This was the crux of the whole climb, but this was a strong team, and it was infused with summit fever. By the time I rounded up to see the upper view of the summit mushrooms, strongman Tim was already leading up through a runnel between two bulbous barriers. Tim was not just strong, he was obsessed, and this was a defining moment for Tim. When I reached the crux pitch, I was delighted to find that it was not as hard as feared. The snow was like styrofoam, and with my two tools sinking to the hilt, I front-pointed right up. Above the pitch was a gentle slope where I caught up with Chris and Bob, who were busy unroping. Like King Peak, we would do the final summit stroll unroped. From this stance, the view opened to the north for the first time on the climb. There was Logan and King Peak! I was returning yet another gaze, but this one was different. The funky sky seemed full of ice crystals, and the view was soft, even unreal. We were indeed quite alone in a unique position. As Chris and I started crunching toward the summit, Chris also felt it and said in a serious tone, "Roach, we've never been this far out there." Approaching the final summit rise, I passed Tim, already coming down. He didn't need to hang around for summit hoopla. He was already obsessed with getting down. St. Elias is just 8 feet over 18,000 feet, and I had long visualized what the last 8 feet would feel like. After 40 years of dreaming about St. Elias as one of those impossible peaks, here it was, and I didn't break stride. I shared the summit with Chris and Bob. Walking to the south edge of the rounded summit area, I radioed Mike and told him that we were on top. He was happy, but also melancholy that he was not with us. When it finally dawned on me that I had climbed the 10 highest major peaks in North America, I posed for a portrait. I was the first person to complete this feat. Knowing that the summit is only halfway and that we had a long, testy descent ahead of us, we started down. As is often the case, the descent was tougher than the climb. Our team consisted of strong individuals with different opinions about how to proceed. Tim and Jim were already in motion down, unroped, and Bob took off unroped after them. Chris stayed with me, and roped, we started a slower but safe descent. For safety, I liked to face in and chunk boom, down at speed. Chris was comfortable facing out, but if I fell, I doubted that he could stop me in that position. Thus, I didn't see the rope as security, and increased my resolve to not fall. It was unthinkable that Chris might fall. Slowly, we descended as the afternoon faded toward evening. We took a short break on the lower angle slopes near 15,000 feet. On the slopes below, we could see the tents, but I was also aware that almost there is not the same as there. Still facing in, I continued my careful chunk boom descent. Chris was now both tired and impatient to be there. Without warning, I looked to my left and saw Chris falling past me at speed. He was in perfect self-arrest position, but his ice axe was just ripping through the crust. Calmly, I prepared for the jerk that I knew was coming. I stomped both crampons in with gusto, bent my knees slightly, and jammed my tools into the hilt. When the jerk came, it was stronger than I expected. I was within a whisker of holding my position, but the lack of that whisker was vital. I jerked out of my position and vaulted into the air. Never a gymnast, I sailed through a perfect backflip. As calm as a meditation, I focused on hitting the snow prone and getting into self-arrest position. I did exactly that, arrested with knees bent to keep my crampons out of the snow, slowed, and computed when I should jam my crampons in to stop my motion completely. I was convinced that Chris was still hurtling toward the ocean and expected another jerk. My calculations were a little off. When I jammed my crampons into the snow, I still had too much speed and vaulted into the air a second time. I did a second backflip, and this time spent a figment wondering if my 10-peak odyssey was going to end here. Rational thought returned, and I gently cursed myself for jamming my crampons in too soon. I resolved to get it right the second time around. Arresting again, I waited a little longer and jammed my crampons in at the perfect time. I stopped and immediately looked for Chris, expecting him to be still sliding down. To my surprise and joy, Chris was stopped just 30 feet away. Both puffing steamy breaths, we just looked at each other. Finally, Chris uttered, "Nice catch, Roach." Unknown to me during my flips, the initial jerk had stopped Chris. Then he had to watch me sailing and flipping through the air, wondering if I was headed for the abyss. We huffed and puffed for a couple more minutes, then stood and carefully completed our descent to the tents. When I reached the tents, I had another problem. I could not get my crampons off my boots. Tim was already asleep in the tent, and Chris had also crawled in. Finally, I just undid my boots with crampons still attached, left them in the tent vestibule, and crawled into the tent in my socks. I would deal with my crampon boot mess in the morning. The rest of our descent continued to be a trial. The next day, we descended the no-fall zone back to Hayden Col. Using the technique from Hunter, we placed some anchors for safety, scooted down on long sections of rope, then the last man would climb down free with the gear. The sea of clouds that had been below us for days was still intact, but now we had to descend into it. Unexpectedly, we descended into a whiteout, and suddenly it wasn't obvious which way to go. I spotted a key wand that I had left near the top of a little gully, and that kept us on track. We reached Col Camp to discover that many feet of snow had fallen here, and that it was still snowing hard. It took hours to dig everything out and prepare for the night. With snow filling the air, the night's gloom upon us, we decided that we needed not one, but two people out of the tents shoveling all night long to prevent the tents from being buried. When my shift came, I suited up, crawled out into the snowy somberness, and shoveled with vigor for an hour. At the end of my labor, the camp didn't look any different. Snow was coming in as fast as we shoveled it out. Then I decided to go outside the camp to see how much snow we were really dealing with. I climbed up out of the camp pit and struggled 20 feet away. I had dealt with a lot of snow in my decades of mountaineering on high snowy peaks, but I now set a new record. The snow was up to my neck and threatened my breath. I was swimming in snow. I carefully dog-paddled back to my tent. Welcome to St. Elias. When the vague light of the new day filtered in, it was all hands on deck. Shovel, pack, shovel, pack, shovel pack. It was a grim affair. Out of food, we had to descend. We had no choice. Finally, we strapped on our snowshoes and skis and set sail into the sea of snow. Strongman Tim, who had spent his life in the snow, led out of camp on his beloved skis. After 100 yards, our ragtag procession stopped, and we plowed forward to understand the problem. Tim's skis had taken a submarine dive and were stuck 8 feet down. When I passed him on my snowshoes, he was just sitting there in wonderment. Even Tim had never seen anything like this. The three of us on snowshoes took over the lead and created a deep trench. Progress was slow at best, but this A-team was now in motion to get the hell off this mountain. Power step, power step, power step. So far we had been going downhill, but now faced the long traverse under Hayden's avalanche slope. The risk of death was in the air, but the snow was a little better on this open slope. We took turns leading, and the leader would proceed in charge mode, then the next man would take over. Like a slow-motion peloton, we crept across the slope. Still exposed to avalanche, we finally reached the uphill climb back to the ridge containing our base camp. Chris, with a burst of uphill strength, had skied up the slope, dropped his load in a safe place, and skied back down to help the rest of us. It was a selfless act. It was a brutal struggle all the way back to base camp, but we made it. Surely we would be safe here. The next morning was clear. Oh, joy! What could possibly go wrong now? Ahem! This was still a high place exposed to the mighty Pacific Ocean. An onshore wind appeared and quickly assumed gargantuan speed. When we had sagged into this camp the evening before, we had not secured the tents for such an event. We were home, right? Not. Almost there is not the same as there. Chris and I huddled in our tent, which was the most exposed to the wind, and couldn't even shout at each other. We needed to get out of the tent and go to work to secure it, but we needed both of us in the tent to keep it from sailing away off the ridge. Chris put his back on the tent wall against the wind, spread his arms wide, and looked like a mannequin on a sinking ship's bow. Bob, in a more protected tent, got out and saved the whole camp. He grabbed the skis and jammed them deep to secure the upwind guy lines. Finally, back in A-team motion, we finished securing the camp. Base camp is not the same as home. Now, how were we going to fly out from this exposed ridge? Then it was Paul Klaus to the rescue. After the wind fizzled, Paul, the master high flyer, plucked us one by one from the ridge and delivered us back to his staging area on the Seward Glacier. Chris had left his wallet back at the Klaus Ultima Thule Lodge, so he flew in the Cub with Paul back to the lodge. There, he unexpectedly met the famous actor Jim Carrey, who had escaped to this remote lodge for some quiet time. Even though Jim was there to get away from people, he was ecstatic to meet Chris, who was the real deal, arriving back after a monster magic adventure. The rest of us loaded into the Beaver, and Paul's dad flew us back across the Bagley ice field directly to Chitna. As we flew and flew and flew across one of North America's greatest arrays of ice, a multitude of peaks passed in review. Many of the summits were unnamed and many were unclimbed. I mused that I had only scratched the surface. After my struggle to summit St. Elias at age 57, I knew that it was not me, but the mountains that were in charge. To this day, I keep a large photo of the Bagley ice field on my wall that shows Lucania, Logan, and St. Elias. With the fuel gauge pegging on E, we landed on the Chitna airstrip that I had used for so many of my adventures. We borrowed the Klaus F-350, loaded all our gear in the back, and with Bob driving at an excessive speed, blasted back to Anchorage. We chose food over shower, feasted, then jumped on a flight. Jennifer plucked us from the Denver airport and drove several smelly climbers home. Now it was over, and the 11th movement of my Northern Mountain Symphony had produced an orbital ending to my 10 highest peak quest that had begun 41 years earlier. Also, my map looked much better. Stay tuned for Chapter 13 from Northern Heights, Pilgrimage, East Kahiltna, 2001.